For this presentation, we have Jim Stump from BioLotus.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I am contractually obligated to start with a commercial for BioLotus here. Not really, but in walks BioLotus. I like spreading the word. So most of you probably know about us, Science and Faith Organization, founded by Dr. Francis Collins here, who upholds rigorous science and Christ-centered faith and gracious dialogue. You might not know our new president, who just walked in the door right there, Christine Torjesen. She's just started a couple of months ago, so don't ask her too hard of questions about the history of BioLotus yet, but she is catching on. Here she is looking a little younger, but flexing her science research credentials. And her first big initiative with BioLotus has been what we have called Science is Good. I've talked to maybe three or four of you so far that said, science is good. Yeah, but is it always good? And there are layers of nuance and qualification if we were writing a peer-reviewed paper to that. But we're here working particularly with ASA and Dozer, asking you to stand with us in proclaiming that science is good in our culture right now and filming some short videos. So if you still want to get in on those, there are details at the BioLotus booth. Okay, commercial over. The abstract in the conference program about this session starts with saying that I have a contract with Harper One for a new book. And I realize upon seeing it in the program that that comes across as a little pretentious sounding. And I'm very sorry about that. I had intended it for the people who make decisions about these presentations, so they knew that it was a project that's been taken seriously and that I have some credibility on the topic. But in the public dissemination of it, I fear it comes across as, look at me, and that is not what I intended, and clearly shows that I have a ways to go on my own spiritual journey. But what we're talking about now is the spiritual journey of Homo sapiens. So this is a book I've wanted to write for a long time. It started as part of this bigger project, what I might call my big, beautiful idea I had, but would now refrain from doing so for political reasons. But I got connected to a literary agent who responded to this great big idea saying, it looks sprawling to me. But she thought there was something there, and after lots of pruning, it became The Sacred Chain that came out last year. And the nice thing about that much pruning of a big idea is that there was enough left over to write another book. And that's what I'm trying to do right now. So here's the setup for this new book. In 2015, the Israeli historian Yuval Noah Harari published this popular book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Mankind. And despite its diminutive-sounding subtitle, it's a hefty tome that surveys the history of our species from humble beginnings as small groups of hunter-gatherers down through the scientific, the industrial, and the atomic revolutions. One of the themes throughout the book is to question whether all this progress our species has achieved is really worth it. Are we happier now with our iPhones and Netflix than we were 100,000 years ago back on the savannah? It's tricky to objectively measure and compare across cultures how happy people are today. Does the self-report of an American suburban 16-year-old sense of well-being measure the same thing as that of a rural octogenarian in Mongolia? And if it's difficult to compare these today, how much harder is it to find comparable measures of happiness for our ancient ancestors who didn't leave many records? So Harari thinks that not knowing how happy people were through the different eras of our species development is the greatest deficiency in our understanding of history. And this is not just some curious question we want answers to for the sake of knowledge itself. Rather, he wants to leverage that information to make us happier today. For clearly, he's not very happy with how things have gone. And looking around at his fellow Homo sapiens, he doesn't think the rest of us are that happy either with the world as we've made it. But what if happiness, in that sense of subjective well-being that sociologists try to measure, what if happiness isn't the ultimate goal of our species? What if we were intended for something else, something higher, something holier? I'm not claiming happiness is irrelevant. I want to be happy too. And I'm not persuaded that technology has made us fundamentally happier. But I do think there's a different story that can be told about the history of our species that counters Harari's pessimistic account, one that starts earlier among our evolutionary ancestors and shows a different trajectory for our species, one that, despite recent cultural developments, has a hopeful outlook even. There's a fascinating story about the development of our capacities and abilities that culminates in the remarkable creatures we are today that are capable not only of happiness, but of freedom and of moral responsibility and love. Maybe culminates isn't quite the right word. I don't believe we're at the end of the story of humanity. We're very recent arrivals relative to the history of life on our planet. And despite the doom and gloom of Harari's assessment, I believe we're capable of greater things. And I believe that hearing a better story about our past can point us in a more hopeful direction for a better future. The spiritual journey of Homo sapiens is that story, intended to be so. So it's divided up into seven parts that goes through seeing, walking, thinking, talking, feeling, choosing, loving. For each of these, I have 2 points to make about these evolutionary developments in our past. And you can't hear just one of these points and think you have a decent idea of what I'm trying to do. Both of these must be true in order for the overall case I'm trying to make. So point number one about each of these developments in our evolutionary journey is, see if I can read it. Our capacities, so each of those things that we can do, our capacities have an evolutionary story. They came from somewhere. They're connected to the capacities of other organisms that have those. But the second point is, in the human context, those shared capacities have become something more. Okay, so point number one is we're connected to the rest of life on the planet, and the things that we can do came from somewhere. Point number two is we're radically different from the rest of life on the planet. Okay, so you have to, again, hear both of these. I'm not making a claim of we're only a hairless ape with a slightly upgraded brain. I'm not making the point of human exceptionalism, that we're the only thing in nature that counts. I'm trying to hold these two things together in some tension. One of those points on its own pulls us toward being just another animal with a few upgrades. The other points on its own toward us being something radically different. For example, our ancestors became bipeds. Not through some miraculous or magical episode. There was millions of years of development from a more upright posture in the trees to ground-dwelling, fully upright beings. And there are fascinating developments that we can see over time about this. The really remarkable thing of that is what it did to us and did to our lifestyles. We became vastly different creatures. Obvious one is that we now have hands that are able to manipulate objects. Tool use is not unique to humans, but I think you can hardly put sticking a twig into a termite mound in the same category as using computers to design rockets. Even more astounding than that is how bipedality led us down a path on our spiritual journey through much greater cooperation. So think about mothers and infants and the change that bipedalism made. For chimpanzee moms, when they give birth, they go off somewhere by themselves, have the baby. No one else touches it for about 6 months. Baby can cling to mom even when she's moving around and climbing, because she's usually moving with her back parallel to the ground and she's really hairy. But if you're bipedal, you're standing upright, You've become adapted for long distance moving, lost most of your body hair, so sweating is more efficient. And now baby has nothing to hang on to. So mom has to use one of her arms and her hip. That seems like a huge survival disadvantage for avoiding predators or gathering food. And any disadvantage for moms and their babies is going to be a problem for the evolution of a species. So how do you adapt? You hand baby off to someone else when you go to forage or if you need to climb a tree. This radically changes the hominin communities from which we evolved. Or at least we should say the hominin communities who became more cooperative were the ones that survived. There's a lot of detail we could go into just about these episodes here. The importance of grandmothers, say, about sexual selection for dads who would stick around and help out with the kids. About the self-domestication of our species. These are important stages in the spiritual journey of our ancestors. But I'm going to skip ahead to the sections I'm working on right now as it pertains to cooperative societies and see another step in our spiritual journey, in the spiritual journey it facilitates. In the thinking and talking parts of this book, we see the development of bigger brains and the development of language. Our brains are about 3 times bigger than expected for primates with our body size. But it's not just a volume issue. It's which parts got bigger and what are they used for and how it leads to something very different. And the big deal here is that our brains became the kind of brains that can learn from others, which is a function of cooperation, a development of cooperation. By comparison with chimps, again, they can learn from others, but it's almost entirely relegated to learning from mom. That leads to a very slow development of knowledge, and a cumulative culture is almost entirely absent, with some minor counterexamples. But again, the difference would be like tools, where we're comparing twigs to computers again. So cultural evolution became the name of the game that we excelled at. And in many ways, our brains became collective brains. Sounds like the Borg, but stick with me. Over the last 50,000 years, our lives have become radically different. Why? Not because of genetics. Not because of biological evolution. And even though our cognitive abilities became much higher, I don't think it's primarily because of that. Rather, it's because we, alone among creatures, figured out how to share knowledge at scale. Since this is the ASA and not one of my philosophy conferences, I'm going to lean into a quantified example of what I mean. So I've taken this from Joseph Henrich in his book, The Secret of Our Success. But he didn't give the math there, and I ended up changing a couple of the parameters. But what we're going to do is talk about the development of a new technology and how it might spread through a population and through generations. So let's say a bow and arrow. You could easily see how learning to use a bow and arrow could radically change a community in terms of food sources that are opened up, as well as defense against intruders, or maybe even offense against other communities. But to quantify the spread of this technology, there are a few variables. So Q of T here is how many people already know how to do this within a population, and then P is going to be the individual innovation probability. So per person, per generation, how often can someone in your community invent this technology? K is going to be how many people can you attempt to learn it from, or how many people can you try to teach it to? And S will be the probability that seeing somebody else do it, having somebody else teach it to you, results successfully in you being able to do it. Okay? So once we know these variables, we can calculate how many people in a given generation will acquire a technology, and then we can run the clock forward and see how many people will have it in successive generations. So this is the formula that ChatGPT and I figured out from the numbers that Joseph Henrich gave in his book, that we came up with identical numbers. So I'm pretty sure this is correct, of taking these variables and putting it in here to see how in successive generations a technology can spread. So here are a couple of groups. Let's say we've got 5,000 people in a community adopting a new technology. Here's one such community that I've called the smart but loners. So here P is 0.1. That's one person. It takes 10 generations for one person to learn it, or within a community like this, one out of 10 people in a generation can invent the technology. But they're not very social. So they're the smart but loners. The K was how many people can you try to teach it to? And S then is what's the probability of success when you try to teach it? So 50% of the time it works. One out of 10 people can invent it in any given generation. They can try to teach one other person, and it's successful 50% of the time. Here's a different group that I called the dim but social people. Their P is 1 out of 1,000 can invent the technology, or within any community, 1 out of 1,000 people in a generation can invent the bow and arrow, but they can try to teach it to 10 people. And again, it's successful 50% of the time. What do you think happens in these two communities when you play these out? Well, the adoption of the technology after just 5 or 6 or 7 generations is essentially universal in this community that is 10 times more social, 100 times less intelligent. 100 times less intelligent, but 10 times more social leads to nearly universal acceptance of the technology, where the smart people only get up to 18% because they can't pass it around very well. Huh. Those were Henrik's numbers, but I wondered, though, whether to be fair to the smart but loner population, that they'd have a higher success rate at learning from other people. Maybe learning isn't just a function of how smart you are, but it seems like it should be relevant, right? So I adjusted the values to the smart but loner population and gave them a 75% chance of learning it from other people. And I dropped the dim but social people to 25% chance of learning it from other people. And you still get this graph. You still get the graph where social beats smarts every time. Which group is more successful? Which group would you rather be part of if you're depending on it for learning how to eat or defending yourselves? Joseph Henrik summarizes this with, once we understand the importance of collective brains, we begin to see why modern societies vary in their innovativeness. It's not the smartness of individuals or the formal incentives. It's the willingness and ability of large numbers of individuals at the knowledge frontier to freely interact, exchange views, disagree, learn from each other, build collaborations, trust strangers, and be wrong. Innovation does not take a genius or a village. It takes a big network of freely interacting minds. There's some easy political commentary to be made there, which I will skip. But now there's a problem, and I'm going to run out of time is my problem. I just said, here's a community with 5,000 people in it. How do you get one of those? There's a very big difference in that from the size of communities 100,000 years ago. And it turns out to be pretty tricky with primate psychology. You've probably heard of Dunbar's number, which is really robustly evidenced number that holds across cultures for how many relationships you can maintain at a time. For humans, that number is about 150. Of course, we know more than that. You know about 1,500 people on average, but maintaining a relationship requires a bit more. So 150 people that we'd call our current friends. Of those, about 50 are good friends. And of those, about 15 are best friends. And of those, about 5 are our inner circle. It's an interesting exercise to place the people you know into those. This tracks pretty well with how much communication we have with them, how much we perceive an emotional bond to them, and how much we'd be willing to do for them. Chimp brains are a little less than a third the volume of ours, and it turns out that Dunbar's number for them is a little less than a third of ours, too, about 45 individuals they can maintain relationships with. And that's the size that chimp colonies max out at, where they have very complex social dynamics between the members. So how do they maintain their relationships? Through grooming. They groom and are groomed by some individuals more than others, so their Dunbar's number also has a hierarchy of concentric circles. And there's some physical health advantage to this, right? They take out parasites and fleas. But the real advantage is psychological. Grooming produces a wash of endorphins, resulting in goodwill toward the person you are grooming and the person who's grooming you. That keeps peace among the members. Outside of that group, where they don't have personal relationships, things are pretty tense between individual chimps. You've maybe heard the claim that you could never get a bunch of chimp strangers to ride a bus together. There's a very strong in-group versus out-group dynamic. But then somewhere, somehow, between the campfire circles of the late Pleistocene and then these teeming Neolithic towns in what we call Turkey now, our ancestors succeeded in stitching dozens of 150-sized bands into villages, chiefdoms, cities of several thousand. How? These days, there's a fair bit of cultural lip service to Harari's answer. We invented imaginary gods to police the strangers. He calls this telling stories and goes to some length to argue that stories rule the world by controlling our behavior. And on the face of it, there's some intuitive bite here. In communities where you're in relationship with everyone, it's your reputation that keeps you in line. If you do something selfish that harms the larger group, everyone knows it's you, and you'll be shunned. In bigger communities, such acts could slip by unnoticed. But if you've been convinced by the story of an all-seeing deity that keeps a ledger on every hidden deed, ready to dole out blessings or punishments both now and in some everlasting hereafter, you suddenly have a powerful incentive to behave, even when no flesh and blood witness is present. Such supernatural monitoring extends the size of the community we can live with peaceably beyond the 150 we actually know. Skipping ahead, I think this explanation sells religion short. Robin Dunbar himself gives a richer and more empirically grounded account in his book, How Religion Evolved. He starts with this grooming problem that if you're limited to one-on-one physical contact, group size for primates with our brain volume would be capped at about 150. But language, laughter, music, ritual are what he calls vocal grooming. They release the same endorphin cocktail as grooming does, but can be experienced by many people at once without physical contact. A communal hymn, a drumming circle, allows one speaker to bond simultaneously with scores of listeners. Processions and shared meals and scale this effect even further. So religion in this view is not first a moral scorecard imposed from above. It's a technology of belonging that stretches viable community size beyond Dunbar's number. Only after that emotional cement is poured do some adherents of religion build on that foundation of moral scaffolding or scorekeeping, determining who is in and who is out. One more minute. Seen this way, religious practice is an evolutionary upgrade on Henrik's collective brain. Having a naturalistic story of how religion developed shouldn't be any more threatening than having a naturalistic story of how humans evolved or how the Hawaiian Islands were formed. These explanations don't compete with the theological lens that God created Hawaii, that God formed us together in our mother's wombs, that God revealed himself to people, and they responded with worship. Of course, the power that binds an in-group can also sharpen the boundary against outsiders. And our history is littered with crusades, pogroms, lynchings committed in the name of clan, nation, or religion. Yet the same mechanisms that once forged this parochial solidarity have in the long arc of our human story been repurposed to enlarge it. Declarations of human rights, interfaith dialogue, even global scientific collaborations are all descendants of that original ritual circle. This is why I call this story a spiritual journey. We've made progress, but haven't arrived at the destination yet, and the path we've taken has done something to us. I'll stop there. Thank you.
We may have time for one quick question.
My additional take on Harari is the probability of being a slave when you were hunter-gatherer was much less than our modern civilization. Paul tells us, slaves obey your masters. So, a great Christian accepted slavery, and we accepted slavery in this country until after the Civil War.
We've made some progress.
We've made some progress.
Thank you.